This is the GI Microcast for Monday, March 18th, 2024. I am James Batchelor, Editor-in-Chief of GameStreet.biz, and I am joined by staff writer Jeffrey Rousseau. Thank you very much. Microcast debut. How are you doing, sir?
Yeah, I'm doing great. I'm doing great this morning. I'm caffeinated and I'm ready to go. How are you?
Good. That's good. I'm okay. I'll be honest, I'm impressed that Chris did not get up at 3 a.m. to record the Microcast with me. He was up at 3 a.m. I'll clarify that now. I was still having DMs from him, you know, direct messages from him at 3 a.m. San Francisco time. But he didn't say, hey, you should record the Microcast. So I took that as he wanted to get some more sleep. Yeah. In the absence of Chris, then, you are going to be helping me dive through some of the biggest stories of the past week. We're going to start with, I'd say, the biggest story of last week, which is Embracer selling Saber Interactive for $247 million. Now, this is the first major divestment that Embracer Group has done. Embracer Group, as we all know by this point, is having a lot of trouble with long-running debts. It's trying to reduce that debt. End of 2023, its debt was $1.4 billion, down from $1.5 billion when they started restructuring in June. The sale of Saber shaves off about $200 million off the debt, so not an insignificant amount of cash, I guess. The split's been really interesting. So it's not just they've sold... When they originally acquired Saber... They just bought Saber. Since they acquired Saber in, I think it was 2020, a lot of the acquisitions they've made, they've put underneath Saber, as Saber was one of its 12 operating groups. And so this sale is not just the sale of Saber, but it's the sale of a bunch of the different studios. The official word on which ones have gone where is Saber will keep Nimble Giant, 3D Realms, Sandbox Strategies, New World Interactive, Slipgate, Madhead Games, Fractured Bite, and Digic. Embracer is going to keep Zen Studios, 4A Games, Tripwire, Beamdog, Tuxedo Labs, Demiurge, Shiver, Aspire, Snapshot, and 34 Big Things. There's confusion, I think, over a couple of those. I think 4A Games, it's believed, may have gone with Saber, but that was kind of the official word or how it was communicated at the time that it was actually sold. Really interesting one. Like, Embracer are drastically trying to bring down that debt. They've laid off 1,400 people before the end of January, you know, this year. We haven't had any other layoffs since, I don't believe, but that's not to say they won't happen. They've closed studios, they closed Campfire Cabal, they closed Free Radical, they closed Volition, but this is the first time they essentially sold off a 12th of their company, not in terms of size, but because you look through the different operating groups and their different sizes, but in terms of the structure of it, it sold off a 12th of the business. I mean, Jeffrey, what was your thoughts on their decision to sell Saber?
So I remember I reported the story about it reportedly happening, and at the time it was said, and I believe that it still is the biggest debt that they got rid of, but so still, far. Yeah, so far. And the thing is, in the report, in their financials, they still said, we don't think that we'll be hitting that reduction that we're trying to target. And to me, when you step back, and I like to say this on the record, I think Embracer will be it will be something to study in regards to the games industry growth and what happens when you need to hit the panic button, right? Because they went into that restructuring program. The thing is, when we heard about that, I thought, okay, but what does that mean exactly? Even though when you read it, what does that mean exactly? Like you said, a number of people were laid off. I still think about Volition Studios being closed down, all these different studios to reduce things. And then you have Saber essentially just break off, and it is bringing these studios along with it, like you mentioned. The thing that still gets me is that when I think about that, that they still haven't hit their target for the debt that they're trying to reduce. So what more will we see is the thing I keep thinking about. Saber essentially, if I'm not mistaken, that amount was almost half of what it was purchased for. Isn't that right?
Well, there's confusion there because I tried to make that comparison. I wrote This Week in Business this week because Brendan was jetting off to San Francisco. And I tried to make the comparison because the Saber was bought. Saber was bought in a deal worth $525 million. And it was sold for $247 million. Now, the slight confusion there is the actual purchase price, I believe, was like $325 million. And then the $525 million was based on payouts and performance and the usual kind of earn-out clauses you get in the years after an acquisition. We don't know if those targets were met.
Mm.
Based on Embracer's troubles, I would guess not. But we don't know. You can't. It's not a direct comparison, because I tried to make that comparison and Brendan corrected me.
Well, okay. Well, this just goes back to my earlier point. So they're going to finish the fiscal year at wherever they'll be at.
Mm.
And a question I keep asking myself, what more will we see?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the question I tried to answer in this week in business. So you're right. They're going to end the financial year with, I estimate, at least $1 billion in debt. And they had originally aimed to half their debt, or at least bring it down to like kind of the, yeah, bring it under $1 billion at least by end of fiscal year. Now, in their latest financial report, the CEO last week and forward said that there are, I think the exact words were along the lines of several large divestments potentially in the work. So they are talking to people about buying other areas of their business. The rumor that has been going around since September is that Gearbox is going to be sold and all the Gearbox studios. So he's suggested that there's more sales in the works, and he said like these should significantly reduce the debt after the end of the financial year. So I reckon over this summer we'll see them shed a lot of weight, as it were, and we'll see more sales. This is kind of what I went with This Week in Business. So This Week in Business, I went through the 11 remaining operating groups and looked at which ones might sell, because you forget, it was kind of interesting, kind of a recap of how much they own, because you forget how much they own and how recently they bought certain things. Rumours are that Gearbox is going to go. That rumour has been going for ages. So that would be Gearbox, obviously a lot of the development studios, but Gearbox has also got its own film and TV studio now, which is making the Borderlands movie. And then a couple of smaller, like co-dev sort of studios like Lost Boys Interactive. I wouldn't be surprised if that one went. I mean, it is perhaps the biggest in terms of the game space, in terms of AAA brands and so forth, but equally that means it must be quite expensive to run, I guess. It's not actually the biggest division in terms of headcount. I believe the headcount I had to go from Embracer's investor relations page, and they say that they update the headcounts for each operating group after each quarter. So most recently it's 1,543 people. I think that makes it the third or fourth biggest operating group. The biggest one is Asmodee, which is all their tabletop stuff. And I'm really intrigued to see what they do with that, because tabletop games are huge.
Yep, yep.
That industry, I believe, is growing, or at least thriving well. And in their latest financials, and these are the full year financials, tabletop was actually the biggest revenue generator for Asmodee by like quite a little bit of a margin. So console and PC, I think, was about half a billion SEK behind it, or something like that. There was a significant difference. It wasn't like just behind it. Mobile was its smallest, so it's actually got two mobile divisions. It's got Deca Games, which is a bunch of hyper casual studios, and then Easy Brain, which is another group of like, they do more of the kind of the very kind of mainstream, like Sudoku, crosswords, that sort of game. The sort of games that people don't even consider to be games, like. But I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, you know what I mean? Like the sort of thing that commuters will play and not think they're playing a video game. And that apparently is quite a good one, revenue generator. But even then, mobile is by far and away their smallest business in terms of generating revenue. So will they hold it to keep a presence in mobile because mobile's the biggest part of the market? Or will they shift it off? And it's... I don't know. I've made this very clear in the article. I'm not going to predict what they go with, but if you were Embracer, Jeffrey, what would you sell?
Oof, that is a good question, because you mentioned Gearbox, and I'm thinking, okay, so you have a well-known video game brand that's now going to cross into cross media. We don't know how well the Borderlands movie will do. I don't know if it'll end up being an Academy Award-winning type of thing. Who knows? But if that does kind of the Dungeons and Dragons thing, where like it kind of like injects more people into a brand, who knows? I don't know. If on paper it makes sense for them to lower that debt, then by all means. While you were mentioning mobile, I was thinking, well, I'd get rid of that. But who's to say what's going to happen in September, right?
Yeah. It's a difficult one. Briefly on the Borderlands one always confused me as well, because obviously Borderlands is owned by Gearbox, but the publishing rights and all that are still with 2K. So any benefit that Embracer gets from Borderlands, yeah, like if the Borderlands movie does really well and, like you say, like gets loads of people buying Borderlands games, they share that benefit with 2K. So is it worth holding on to it for half a benefit or whatever the percentage is, depending on the agreement? Or is it worth thinking, well, actually, we're not reaping the full benefits, let's just shift it? I don't know. It's going to be really interesting to see. Embracer has been very kind of closely watched. I think Embracer is kind of the poster child for what's happening in the industry at the moment in terms of companies that have grown too fast, not organically grown, have not got to the point where they're sustainable, and are now trying to streamline themselves and focus. With other companies, it's easier to see what they focus on, because a lot of companies kind of go back to their core strength. The example I always end up giving is Creative Assembly. Creative Assembly cancelled Hyenas, which is a multiplayer shooter, yes. And they are focusing just on strategy games because that's their bread and butter. That's what they know. Right. With Embracer Group, because it's such a diverse group, I mean, I clarified this in the article, that is a group that covers mobile games, PC games, console games, accessories, there's film rights in there, there's book publishing, there's board games. There is an Embracer-owned company that basically sells Viking clothwear. Like clothing. They're Viking clothing. If you want to dress like a Viking, there is a business owned by Embracer. That's like, when you've got that broader group, what do you focus on? What do you sell? Like, they have these ambitions to become something so much more than games. Right. They have these ambitions to become this vast entertainment company, and they've grown too fast, they've spread too thin. I mean, I'm not saying anything that we don't already know. and it's really intriguing to see. I'm rambling, but I'll finish on. I'm really interested to see what Embracer comes out of this, which form of Embracer comes out of this. Because at the moment, as I say, it's got these fingers and all these different pies. The one that comes out of this, the one that finishes the restructuring program, will be a lot more, or should be, a lot more concentrated and focused on what it wants to go for. And that's, so if it decides it's going to focus on AAA games, for example, or just console and PC games, it needs to really dedicate itself to that space going forward and be a lot more careful in how it grows.
I think ultimately whatever they decide to do, the industry will still look at it as example of, maybe we don't want to do that. If we are in that position, maybe we don't want to, in case deal falls through, because again, it's the numbers are incredible. I don't laugh because it's funny. I laugh because
it's hard to process, it's unreal. Let's talk about another story. So this two more stories that actually broke today. The first one is Sony is reportedly stopping PlayStation VR 2 production. Now, I emphasise this is reportedly, this kind of source inside. Jeffrey, you actually covered this story, so I'm going to kind of put you on the spot and ask you to tell us what's going on.
Yeah, so the thing with that story is that sources familiar with the matter essentially said, hey, they're stopping production as of right now because they want to clear out the current stock. And the same source also said that Sony has made in a ballpark of 2 million of these units. So that's concerning in the sense that we have not gotten sales numbers about the PSVR 2 since it came out. I mean, we have one story that I've referred to twice where they said within 6 weeks, it hit 600,000. You could see it referenced there, which would have placed it like 8% higher than the original model. But still, it's that, even within our Sony report, I was looking to see if they put sales numbers in there, but it's not. So one has to wonder, how bad is it? And another thing I'd like to add that I've added in my story is that we get this shortly after we found out that Sony is testing PC compatibility for the PSVR 2, meaning that they understand there's a market there. Will this help us sell it? Hopefully. The thing I think about is that it's not doing well. Professionally, I think it's not doing well, because anything that does well, James can tell you, we get press releases. Hey, this is selling this much. He's like, thank you. We'll get like three emails back to back. Okay, we understand. We'll report it when we get to it. I don't know what's going on with the PSVR 2. Maybe that price tag of $550 did not help. I don't think it did.
No.
You know?
No. I mean, blimey, $550 for something that is not even standalone. You need a $500 console attached to it, or however much the PS5 is going for these days. Like, it's PSVR 2 was always going to be an interesting one. It's an interesting kind of... like, PlayStation was at one point like the VR market leader. Like, when PC VR headsets weren't selling particularly well, there was a really good kind of attach rate for the original PSVR on PlayStation 4. And then PSVR 2, I don't know, it's just lacked fanfare. And I don't just mean, like, because you're absolutely right, they haven't announced kind of big sales figures. And generally speaking, if a company doesn't tell you how much something has sold, it's not sold as much as they wanted it to. So we can surmise that it hasn't sold particularly well. But yeah, even before that, like, they didn't seem to be making as big a deal about it as you would think. Like, you know, virtual reality is a niche, and I'm convinced it's going to remain a niche. It will be a niche that may become sustainable for those who are heavily invested in it, but it will remain a niche. It won't get to the point where you've got hundreds of millions of people sticking on headsets and playing games. I just don't believe that's going to happen. Right. Not hundreds of millions, tens of millions, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
hundreds of millions, that really is Ready Player One. So it's a niche, it's a potentially sustainable niche, but it's not going to become mainstream. Even so, you need to kind of shout from the rooftops about it to get people excited about it. And, I mean, the launch just kind of came and went for PSVR 2. The game lineup doesn't seem to be absolutely huge. I mean, it still baffles me that it's not backwards compatible with the original PlayStation VR, right? Because then you'd have been launching with, like, these, you know, wider range of titles. They don't seem to be doing much with it first-party-wise. Obviously, we have that Horizon spin-off, but there don't seem to be many PlayStation brands that are going for it. They're like, they've kind of... it's almost like they've put it out there. They've done a first-party title in Horizon, so you've got some sort of Sony presence there. But then other than that, it's just... it's an accessory that smaller third-party developers can develop for. I mean, it's been a whole year, and
yes, honestly, it's been a year since its launch. Yeah, yes.
It's been a year. Like, I honestly, when I was doing end of year recaps, I forgot that we had a hardware launch last year. We had PlayStation VR 2. Like, it's, you know, the new State of Play. Every time there's a State of Play kind of presentation, one of their Nintendo Directs. Yep. Like, you might get the announcement. I think they last announced that there's a Metro game coming to VR, but it's never like a pillar of the presentation. It's usually in a montage, or it's usually a shorter presence. There's again, nothing first party. Right. You kind of have to wonder how invested in virtual reality Sony is.
I tend to wonder that myself. Again, looking at the... when we get those earnings reports, it's like, is this not worth a paragraph or a couple of sentences? I don't know what's going on. The thing, when I think about its launch, I remember specifically, I was like, wait, so you're hand selecting titles that did well on your original console, and then it's not backwards compatible? You know, I remember I had an interview with a developer, and they pretty much said something of that. As a VR developer, it would behoove you to not worry about a particular device exclusivity versus just being available everywhere. So I think about that. I don't know what's going on with the PSVR 2. It seems like it encompasses this much of, like, Sony's priority. And you're sitting on supposedly 2 million, again, reportedly, we don't know if this is true or if we'll ever get word, 2 million units that have not sold. That's not good either.
I mean, it might be unfortunate timing. I mean, like, these things take years to kind of develop and process and get ready. And obviously, like, it launched when, like, costs are increasing, cost of living is increasing, like, particularly in the Western world. Like, but I imagine, like, globally, like, you know, we are in economically uncertain times, and economically uncertain times is not the time to be selling a $550 headset that requires a $500 console with it. Like, it, you know, the number of people. Again, going back to my VR is niche thing, the number of people who can afford to buy a headset that has a limited range of games compared to the base console that it's attached to is somewhat limited. Like the number of people that can afford that kind of luxury, it is kind of a luxury. Like, you know, yeah, it's really, yeah. We're still in very kind of the early adopter sort of phase of virtual reality, in terms of the people who buy it are the ones who want to get in on the ground for like the next big thing in tech. Yeah. People can't, I mean, when you've got people griping over how much, you know, like, people are griping over a $70 price tag for video games, they're not going to be buying a $550 headset because they can't. So it might be unfortunate timing that whenever PSVR2 was greenlit and work began on it, it might be that, you know, the projections for the economy were a lot stronger. Yeah. So maybe they're kind of, I don't know, limiting the damage, as it were. But and equally, it may be that they're kind of just pausing things now before they regroup and then do something bigger. As you say, like, there's reports that it's going to be made compatible with PC. That would make sense, given the vast majority of VR now is on PC, whereas it once was PS4, it's now PC. There's so many different headsets there. Sony is doing more on PC by bringing more of its first-party games, none of them VR compatible, but, you know, it's... Yeah, we don't know, but it is interesting, like, for a hardware device and a hardware platform that has had such a low profile in its first year, to find out that it may well already be pausing production is a warning sign.
Yeah. It's that. It's when platform holders and companies hit that supposed panic button, I was like, uh-oh, what's going on?
Yeah.
You know.
Okay, last story I kind of want to talk about, again, another one that broke today, is Unity have released their 2024 gaming report. So every year, GDC, Unity releases this gaming report. This draws on data based on everyone that uses the engine itself and its services and so forth. So they estimate approximately 5 million developers have... Like the data from 5 million developers of what they're working on, what they've been using the engine and the cloud and the various products and services for, what that tells us about what's happening in the industry. Additionally, there's kind of a survey of 300 developers to kind of give a little bit more insight. I have spoken to Mark Whitten from Unity about the key findings from this, and the key findings, honestly, we were talking about this kind of on the Slack on Friday, and the key findings aren't that surprising. So the five key trends are: developers are adopting AI tools to save time. Studios are diversifying their revenue approaches. Studios of all sizes are shipping to more platforms. Developers are prioritizing multiplayer games, despite how much they're more complex and they're more costly to develop. And the industry is building stronger brands by extending engagement. What I read there is developers are saving money, are trying to make more money, trying to make more money, trying to make more money, and trying to make more money. Like, it all boils down to just the economically uncertain times we're in. Companies are desperately trying to find more players, more revenue, and make games cheaper, faster, better. And the report was quite interesting, like an insight into this. I'm going to skew into AI first. Oddly, it wasn't actually something that... Mark and I discussed, because we ended up going on for the whole thing on discoverability, but we'll talk about that in a second. AI I found interesting because 62% of the studios surveyed, now I remind you, only 300 people took part in the survey, but 62% of those studios say they already use AI in their workflows, and most of them use it for quicker prototyping or world building. Some do use it for asset creation. I think it's like 36% are using it to generate artwork, artwork and game levels. So that can be honestly anything from like, right, I've made a tree, let's make more trees, and just using AI to kind of speed up that process. 71% of the studios that say they do use AI say that it has improved their delivery and their operations. So there's an argument that obviously there's a lot of resistance around AI. There's a lot of skepticism, the concern about it, you know, it endangering people's jobs. And yes, like that is a very kind of real concern, that if people are going to start using generative AI for things like artwork, for things like asset, you know, like 3D assets and objects, you're removing work from people. But if it's used to kind of speed up development, I personally think that might be a good thing. Like the report also went into how the average time to launch for games is growing. So in the 2022 report, the average game launched after 218 days of development. In 2023, the average game launched, games launched after an average of 304 days of development. Every day is, you know, more pay, more salary, more outgoings, more costs. Like, so if you can find tools, whether that's AI or other kind of services or whatever, that means you can create your game faster, that's got to be better for companies making themselves more sustainable.
The thing, after after writing a couple of on a couple of talks that you know, mentioned the use of AI, particularly with like the general manager of Xbox mentioning that, yes, there's definitely the thought process of we're using AI to help us clear hurdles sooner, because, you know, time is money. I get that, and like you said, there's all these things said about AI, people's jobs, and just what have you. So yeah, I'm not surprised at those statistics. It makes sense. The other thing too, I think about is that the use of AI and how we define it, that's also up in the air because it's been used for so long. It's just that when I read that, a developer is that we're using AI, do you mean something that generatively?
That's takes, the thing, isn't it?
Right.
I think yeah. There's been so much talk about generative AI in the last 2 years that people hear AI and they assume generative. They assume ChatGPT, that sort of thing. And that's not necessarily what people are using. There are very, very, there's a wide array of forms of AI tools. And I think, again, re-emphasizing the point here, like, if there are AI tools that help kind of speed up production, automate kind of the nitty-gritty stuff, the repetitive tasks, that frees up more time for creation and actually have humans creating it, that can be a good thing. And hopefully that's what we're seeing in those statistics. While there are generative AI tools, there are always going to be people who try to use those as well and use... actually, I'm going to find now. There was a graph in the report that actually detailed what people are using AI for. And I think the number one was character animations, which, yes, you're paying animators and so forth, and those people should still be paid to, you still need human animators, human beings to handle your animation. But equally, if you're getting humans to do the kind of the base work and then you're using AI to tweak it and improve it and save them time on just kind of the constant back and forth on making something perfect, also, you know, as close to perfect as possible, then that can be a good thing, I think. So here we go. Here's the graph. 46% of people in this survey, again, 300 respondents, 46% of those 300 developers use AI to improve character animations. 37% use it to write code or speed up code writing. 36% use it to generate artwork and game levels. 36% use for writing and narrative design. 36% use for automated playtesting. Automated playtesting, another, I would argue, good use of AI in development. 35% use it for adaptive difficulty, and then 33% use it for in-game text and voice chat moderation. So there's a lot of different uses there, as we've said. I think the more studios are starting to kind of embrace the possibilities of AI. It's doing it in an ethical way. It's doing it in a way that is genuinely empowering your team and improving the efficiencies of your team rather than replacing them. And that's going to be the balance that a lot of people are going to have to strike.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, unless the report specifies, it doesn't necessarily mean it's using AI to do a full person's role or job. It's literally, there was a stat line you mentioned, and I am so sorry, I forget, where it makes sense that developers would be more but it would make more sense that they would adopt to use it to help them build prototypes or vertical slices faster, because again, when we think about things like funding and trying to find a publisher, you want to spend less time in the planning stages to go out and find someone and show them something. And they're like, we'll help fund this and it will be released in 3 years.
Exactly, yeah. And also, like, as developers, as I so often hear developers say, finding the fun. Like, you know, if you're using AI tools or any tools to prototype faster and find a mechanic that works, a mechanic that's enjoyable, a mechanic that's different, that's innovative, rather than kind of, repeating what you're doing, like, the amount of time that goes into games that get cancelled because something's not quite working. Like, if you can get to that point for quicker, like the you know, I say finding the fun. The other FF phrase I hear from developers a lot is fail faster. Fail faster. It is all about failing faster. If your game is going to fail, if your prototype and your concept is not going to work, it is better to get to that point quicker so you can start on something else. And if AI or other tools help you do that, then yeah, it's absolutely. This is something we're going to, at the risk of a shameless plug, this is something we're going to be exploring a lot in June. Games for Developers is running an editorial event called GI Sprint, which is going to be looking at various different ways of making games faster, better, cheaper, and kind of getting to that point where developers can be more efficient in building their games so that you reduce the time, you reduce the costs, and you get your game to market quicker, but with no less quality. And that's the kind of that's the kind of the balance there to strike. Like, it's we're going to be looking into that a lot this year. So it's going to be interesting how this conversation evolves.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. One thing I will say with that Unity report, I do wish it was a little bigger, because the thing I always think about is like, well, what's this like for developers of different like economic levels? But that's something I always mention in Slack all the time. It's just like, okay, but what about like the 9-to-5 guys?
So it's hard, isn't it? Because they've got to make a report that's vaguely digestible, right. And yeah, particularly if you're drawing on data from 5 million Unity users, then breaking that down is going to take a while.
Right.
They've only got a year to produce each report. So, one more thing I'd pull from the report is, or rather, not necessarily the report, but the conversation I had with Mark Whitten. Was we ended up talking a lot about discoverability, about how you know those five trends are nothing new, like they are just accelerating, and they're getting to the point where more and more people need to make multi-platform games, need to make multiplayer games, need to find ways of getting more money from their games because the costs are rising, because the economic situation is so precarious, so tricky. The trouble is, like, no matter what you do to your game, the real barrier you face is discoverability. Like, you can make a multi-platform game, you can make a multiplayer game, but if people don't find it, if people don't engage with it, then it's a non-starter. This is something that has been talked about for years, like the difficulties of discoverability. I mean, we've seen tens of thousands of games go up on Steam every year. Yeah. I can't even begin to imagine how many go on mobile games. Yeah. Mark Whitten, actually, from Unity, actually said that the number of games released on console is dramatically higher than it used to be like 10, 15 years ago, because obviously all the platforms now enable indies. So making your game seen, making your game heard is a lot more difficult. And like I say, like there's entire conferences and articles and newsletters and so much to talk about discoverability. But we actually ran one on Friday, which was more than a little disheartening, which was Rob Fahey, our contributing editor, wrote a column about how discoverability may be a problem that is not possible to solve. It's not possible to get to the stage where everyone can get their game out there. Like, there are always going to be people who struggle, and that's awful, and that you don't want it to be discouraging, but it's just the nature. Like, you know, there's a limited number of players, there's a limited amount of attention and free time that they've got, there's a limited amount of disposable income they've got if you're not a free-to-play game. So his points about like discoverability, we may not ever solve the problem of discoverability, I thought was an interesting one. Like, I'm intrigued to get your thoughts, Jeffrey.
It's funny that you mention that, because I have a perfect example. One of my favorite games that came out, I want to say towards the end of last year, is a platformer that sold for $5 across Switch and PC. And I found out that from the developer's tweets, it sold something in the ballpark of 10,000 units, which is fine for them because they're like a solo developer. They're small. Like, I don't think the resources that they use were quite like heavily financially, you know, burdening them. But it was successful for them. But the thing is, I'm like, okay, that's 10,000 unit sales across like PC and Switch. But the thing is, how many other games don't get that? It is something that Chris says often in Slack that I don't know. I'm pretty sure he's mentioned on a microcast, is that it is very difficult to try to get people's attention in games. Even though you have all these games, that's why I don't know if you ever take a look. Whenever like there's like a PlayStation sale, a Switch sale, and then you ask yourself, you look at this game, it's like, wow, these production values are really good. This is something within my ballpark. Why am I finding out about this now that it's like $14 and it released 6 months ago, and then you check the developers' like websites and tweets, and then like you see it's just been silent because it probably didn't do well.
Yeah, it's tough. And it's particularly for smaller studios in indie. So Rob's column was actually prompted by, and I kind of missed this initially until kind of Rob brought it to my attention. I don't know if you saw the issue with not the issue with, but the problems faced by Renee Gittins is a indie developer behind I can't remember her name, her studio name, but Renee Gittins. She did a game called Potions: A Curious Tale. And she posted kind of a video lamenting the fact that she had worked 10 years on this game and months and months and months, if not year, you know, year plus on marketing and building up an audience and getting ready and building up to launch on Friday. And the plan was to launch on Friday so that the game stayed in the new and trending bar on Steam over the weekend. And out of the blue, EA dropped 11 back catalogue titles. And it just buried her. She got pushed, and the 11 are like there, like, and then she's like, and this is what Rob was talking about, like, you know, like, it's really, yeah, it's really difficult. Like, the platforms have these algorithms that you can work so hard to kind of work out the optimum time to launch, and then just one bigger company comes out of the blue and completely undoes all your work, and that's really hard to deal with. I don't know what the solution is. Like, there isn't a solution to that, which is disheartening. But like as you say, like it's for all the ones that don't. It's so difficult to have like what's it, survivor's bias.
Yeah,
and we always see like the indies that are doing really well. Like I was going to say, like, you know, for all the ones that suffer, there's something like Balatro. Balatro is a game, you know, the poker themed
roguelike. 1 million units.
1 million units as of today. 1 million units within a month. It was profitable within an hour of being on sale. That's brilliant for that developer, and I'm happy for that developer. But for every one of him or them, local thunk. I'm not actually entirely sure who is behind local thunk. But it's a solo developer. Whoever's behind that, for every one of them, goodness knows how many people suffer. The only thing I'd add is, and I'll finish on this point, is this is true of every entertainment medium.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for every best-selling indie author, there are so many authors whose books have not sold. For every best-selling indie artist, you know, who's getting their songs out there and it's going viral on YouTube, there's so many songmakers who are just being completely missed. And it's wonderful that we've got to this stage where the barriers to getting your creation out there and to your audience are practically non-existent now. Anyone can do it if you've put in the time and the effort and often the investment, and not even that too much of an investment sometimes, but anyone can do it. Anyone can get their work out there, but there's only so many people who can discover it, and it's difficult. The only thing you can do is keep pushing, because yes, it might not be you that makes it big, but equally it might be.
Yep. That's how I explain our business. It might be.
It might be. It might be. On that somewhat semi-optimistic note, optimism with a caveat, we're going to break off there. The GI team is in... Not all of us. I was going to say the GI team is in San Francisco all week. Clearly, Jeffrey and I are not in San Francisco, particularly if you're watching on this YouTube. If you're watching the YouTube version, you know we're not in San Francisco. We've got Chris, Marie and Brendan out at GDC this week. If you're out there, keep an eye out for them. Say hello. They're lovely people. And whereas me, Jeffrey and Sophie are holding the fort back home, we're going to be bringing you all the biggest news from GDC all week. If you go to the site, gamesindustry.biz, there's a tag at the very top, GDC 2024. That's where you find all the news from GDC 2024, obviously. You can find all previous episodes of the podcast and the microcast on the podcasting platform of your choice. You can find the video versions of the microcast at YouTube, and you can find more news, insight and analysis into the world behind video games at gamesindustry.biz.